This sermon is from the series entitled Eyewitness Accounts, the Gospel of Luke, preached at Crossway Church in Battleground, Washington.
Speaking of Hurricane Ida, I saw this headline last night. The storm surge that we are unexpecting is unsurvivable. Now, they took it down within about a half hour, I think, but it was still pretty crazy to read it. But I don't know if you paid attention. I looked at it this morning, and I saw that it's one of these rapid intensity hurricanes where it literally is jumping from class every 24 hours, and it's 7 miles an hour underneath Hurricane 5. They're expecting some pretty nasty stuff. I saw this morning that actually power's already out for a number of people as just the front edge of the storm is coming through. I can't even imagine what those people are thinking. I would feel a sense of desperation, just this huge storm bearing down. So I want you to think about that. What is a time when you have felt desperation, when you felt desperate? I mean, it could be all kinds of different situations. It could be right now. Maybe you're facing a health challenge, and it's hard. Maybe you look at the way even our society is going and all the unrest that's happening, and it's scary. Maybe you feel alone. Relationships that you've been have been destroyed, and you're worried, and you wonder, where is God in all this? Maybe you lost a job and you face financial desperation. Or maybe it's something even as simple as a car breaking down in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, and you have no idea how you're going to make it home, and there's this fear. But I want you to think about what it's like in that moment, because really this is what we find ourselves in today. This feeling of desperation is an emotion that's going to be in a huge thread throughout our passage. Here at Crossway, we just preached through a book, and we are going through Luke. I'm thankful to have 2 weeks off, and I want to thank John, Pastor John. I heard he preached on Revelation last week, and Ralph preached on Luke the week before that. So we're going to pick up where Ralph left off. And so if you remember, Jesus had escaped the crowds, and so he went there, and the huge storm came, and he calmed it, and then he made it to the other side. And there, right off the bat, he meets this man who is completely overcome by the demonic, and Jesus restores and heals him. And today what we're going to find is Jesus sails back, and that's where we find ourselves in our text. But I want you to think about that feeling of desperation as you see there are two people who are in that spot because of different health issues. And here, so this is the word of the Lord. Luke 8, verses 40 through 56. Now, when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. And then a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house because his only daughter, a girl about 12, was dying. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, and I know that power has gone out from me." Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. And then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." And while Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," he said. "Don't bother the teacher anymore." Hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid. Just believe and she will be healed." When they arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She is not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead, but he took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told them to give her something to eat, and her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. Well, I said that this feeling of desperation was going to be one that we see throughout this text, and hopefully you can identify the main characters. The first one is Jairus. He has a desperation because obviously his daughter is on her deathbed. Before that, I want you to, before we look into this, I want you to think about what it would be like for Jesus, who literally left a crowd to try and get away in the ocean. And as I said, he went and calmed the storm and went to the other side. And the minute he comes back, there's still this huge crowd flocking to him. Jesus says in a later, Luke tells us in a later part of it, that they're, it's so intense that they're pressing in on him. Think about just what it would be like to be in that kind of a situation. This is kind of the chaos that's there. And amidst the chaos, Luke tells us that Jairus comes and ignores all the kind of religious leader decorum to try and get Jesus to come and heal his daughter. Now, Jairus is as well-to-do and as well-connected as you can get in the Jewish society. If he's the synagogue leader, it means that he's viewed as a teacher. He's probably wealthy. And he has all kinds of status and success. And yet this man is willing to forego all the things that he should do out of desperation because his one and only daughter, a 12-year-old girl, is on her deathbed. And so he launches himself at Jesus' feet, begging him to come. Statured men would never have done anything like this. For me, this story kind of hits home. I mean, my daughter, Annika, is going to turn 12 here in a couple of months. And I can't even imagine what I would go through as a father if she was in that situation. I would do everything I could to try and bring her healing. And we see that this is exactly what Jairus does. He's a man on a mission. He had heard about this Jesus who had done great healings. And he goes to her to try and bring healing to his daughter. And so he does anything he can in the midst of a crowd. He doesn't care what people, how people view him. Even though he was of stature, he lowers himself at the feet of Jesus. And Jesus comes with him. Can you imagine what it would be like? You come knowing that your daughter's on her deathbed. You humiliate yourself in front of other people and you don't even care because all you want is your daughter to be healed. And lo and behold, the teacher, the one who'd been doing healings all over the place, as we've seen in the book of Luke, says, sure, I'll come. Coming from this place of desperation to this place of hope is where Jairus is at. Now, Luke weaves two different stories. There's another desperate character in here. We don't even know her name. She's a desperate woman, and the only facts that we know is that she is literally the opposite spectrum of Jairus. While Jairus was well-connected and while he was wealthy, this woman emptied her bank accounts to try and stop the bleeding that she has endured for 12 years. I don't really like the way the NIV translates it. The ESV, which is a little bit more kind of literal and translates it, says this, and there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. Now, the NIV says no one could heal her or something like that. But I want us to get the desperate measures that this woman was in. For 12 years, she had bleeding, which in that society would mean that she was considered unclean. Anyone who had bleeding or a discharge was considered unclean, and people needed to stay away from them. They did that because they didn't want the disease to transfer. And so this woman, not only being a woman who was considered lower in society in that day and age, of more of a patriarchal society, but having a bleeding that would consider her unclean, was alone, forgotten. She wasn't allowed to go into the temple to worship. She wasn't allowed to even go into the synagogue. She wasn't even allowed to spend time with her family because they would be all afraid that her uncleanliness would transfer to her, to them. And so this woman is about as desperate as you can get. And not only that, she'd completely wiped out all of her bank accounts. Her hope for the future is gone too. And yet she had nothing, nothing to bring forth because her bleeding was continued. She takes great risk in coming to this crowd because all of them could have done some terrible things. Think about this. If you're considered unclean and people know that, that you were supposed to yell unclean and let people know that you're coming, but she doesn't do any of that. She makes her way through the crowd, this huge kind of emotional thing that we see is pushing against Jesus at great risk. Because if people know that she's unclean and in those tight quarters, she would be, could be caught and she would be in serious trouble, maybe even be put to death because she didn't follow those laws. You could see where the emotions of the crowd could easily turn on her. But yet, She knows that there's something about this Jesus. She'd heard about his healing power, and she didn't even need to touch him. She thought, if only I can get into his presence, and if only I can grab his cloak, then maybe I can be healed. And she does that. The story says, the way that Luke crafts it, is that Luke had made his way. She came up behind him, probably fearing that Jesus was going to get outside of her midst, and she grabbed the edge of his cloak. Now, that could just be the edge of the robe, or it could be these tassels that were there at the end. But whatever it is, she grabbed, and we're told that immediately she was healed. This is Luke the doctor who wants to stress this to us. All the physicians in the world were unable to heal her. She was bleeding, and the minute she touched Jesus' cloak, she was healed. Now, Jesus knows something's going on. He can feel it. He asks the question, "Who touched me?" And at first, she remains silent. Because as I said, she's an outcast woman full of shame. And if people knew her entire story, she could put herself at risk. And she makes a calculated choice. Maybe if she just doesn't say anything, Jesus will ignore it and let it move on. And she can move on with her life, rejoicing of the healing that she had given. That was her hope. She just wanted to get in and out, incognito, nobody knows, and let the healing happen. But Jesus presses the issue. Who is it that touched me? Now everybody says, no, I didn't. And Peter kind of gets annoyed. I mean, he's impatient. He says, look, Jesus, the crowd's pressing against you. I mean, how do you know somebody touched you? To which Jesus responds, he felt that power coming out of him. Peter is always that guy who's going to put his foot in his mouth, isn't he? He's the guy who it's like, hey, Jesus, I know you may be up to something here, but it's just kind of awkward. No one's owning up to the fact that they touch you. Let's move on and get to the more important thing. Let's heal this synagogue leader's daughter and do the mission. But Jesus doesn't allow this moment to pass. He wants to teach this woman and us a lesson. And so he keeps on pushing. And finally, this woman relents. And she shares about her miraculous healing. I want you to think about look at the words that Luke uses to describe. It says that she too came trembling, fell at his feet, and then revealed that an unclean person had come into the presence of all kinds of clean people, and that an unclean person had touched the cloak of a Jewish rabbi and was instantly healed. We often miss this cleanliness and uncleanliness because in our day and age, bleeding and all that kind of stuff doesn't have the social dimension there, but we need to get this. Because in their day and age, the view was that uncleanliness would overtake cleanliness. But in this story, the story that this woman trembling shares because she's afraid of what this Jewish rabbi will say to her and how the crowd will respond, she tells a miracle of having bleeding for 12 years, touching this man's cloak, Jesus' cloak, and instantly being healed. There was a fear there. She had every right to be afraid. But yet, I want you to see the compassion that Jesus shows her. Some of us may think, well, you know, if Jesus really was that compassionate, why didn't he just let it happen? I mean, why didn't he let her be healed and move on? And I think the reason why he wants to do this is because Jesus wants this woman to understand some pretty important truths. The first one is that the cloak wasn't magic. You know, it's not like this charm, good luck charm, that just magically she could touch or heal her. No, it was her demonstrating her brokenness and coming to Jesus in faith and trusting in him that healed her. He wanted her to know that she had an active faith in Jesus. My daughter, your faith has healed you. Go now in peace. And he wants her to feel that peace. So he even says these very tender words, My daughter. Think about this woman who has been ostracized for years. Had to tell people, hey, stay away because I'm unclean. Who risks everything in that moment in the crowd and then almost gets forced into it and is so afraid that if she reveals her story, she's going to get ostracized again. But instead, the man to whom she put her hope and trust in says, my daughter, your shame, your ostracization is gone. You are now a child of God. You are a part of God's family. Nowhere else in Scripture is this kind of language used by Jesus, but he says it to this woman because he wants her to know the huge, powerful situation that happened. Not only did she get healed, but more importantly, now she is a daughter of God. Think about what it would feel like in that moment to have the shame erased and for you to know that you are embraced. This man, Jesus, who you were somewhat afraid of but yet in awe of, speaks these truths to you. It would sink down deep into your heart. It would draw you in a powerful way. This is what Jesus wants this woman to experience. Knowing that she is part of the family of God and knowing that she, because of the faith that she showed in Jesus. Now this feels like a whole nother story. It's kind of interesting that Luke would cast these the way that they are and interweave them, but all the Gospels do it. And I think it's because it brings us these two desperate people. You know, you can get so caught up in the story of this woman that you forget that Jesus is on his way to heal Jairus' daughter. And that's exactly what he is. But this little interlude, it seems, came at the most inopportune time. Because as in the midst of all this, after Jesus had just had this conversation with this woman, news comes, someone comes and tells them that Jairus' daughter is dead. The language here is, don't even bother the teacher anymore. It's a done deal. There's nothing that can be done. Can you imagine being Jairus? I mean, I think you talk about emotional roller coaster, right? You're afraid. Your daughter's on her death door, and you leave her bed in one Hail Mary of an act to try and get Jesus to come and bring healing. You throw yourself at his feet, and he relents, and he does that, and you're on your way, and all of a sudden he's stopped about this healing, and you're just sitting there and anxious. Come on, Jesus, let's go. My daughter, my daughter, my daughter, the desperation. You're happy that she's healed, but you want to see him do your miracle too. And then to hear the news that every father cringes at even thinking about. This daughter that you gave up everything to do, left to try and save her, is now dead. It would have been devastating. If it was me, I would be second-guessing every step along the way. But Jesus sees Jairus' pain, and he assures him that his daughter will be healed. Now, this is a pretty bold statement. I mean, Jairus did just see Jesus perform a pretty major miracle. We saw that he already raised the widow's son from the dead. But could you imagine this kind of hope, but yet wondering if Jesus really can pull this off? This is where Jairus sits. And we're not really told if Jairus has the strong faith or not, but what we see is he continues forward with Jesus. Jesus comes to his house and he takes the three closest disciples, Jairus and his wife, and he brings her into the room that she's in. But on the way, he makes a comment to the crowd. He says, stop wailing. Now, we may not get the Jewish customs, but the Jewish custom was to wail loud. If somebody was dead and you knew they were dead, it was this huge wailing, and it shows their pain and their sorrow, and the crowd is doing that. They are wailing. But when Jesus says, hey, stop wailing, she's dead. She's not dead but asleep. They laughed at him. They scoffed. There's no way. we know what dead looks like, and she's dead. And the language that is used even in here with Luke highlights that about her spirit coming back to life. You know, we were talking in our this week, a couple of our neighbor girls lost their great-grandma, and she was living with them, and so we were actually talking about just the passing with one of them, and one of them had never seen a dead body before. And so my daughters were talking to their daughters about it and remembered a situation where we sat in a hospice room with one of their, well, it'd be their great-uncles, and how his body looked different. You can just tell when somebody's dead, right? There's a different countenance upon them. You can tell the life has gone out. And what these people, the reason why they laughed and the reason why Luke wants to make it clear is that this was not just her sleeping. This was just not her getting weak and everyone thinking she was gone. This girl is dead. But yet, Jesus takes these people, the three disciples and her mother and father, into the room, and he sits down where she's laying, and he says these very tender words again, "My child, get up." Now, if you look at some of the other gospels, they use the Arabic, and I think the reason why they use the Arabic, Luke just uses the Greek because he's writing to a Greek audience, but the tenderness is still there. He says, "My child, get up." I think the reason why the other ones use the Aramaic is because that's probably the language, the phrase that the father would have used to his child every morning, at least when he wasn't trying to get her up really quickly. "Honey, my dearest, get up." These are the words of compassion that Jesus tells this 12-year-old daughter. He picks her up by the hand. He says, "My child, get up." And lo and behold, the miracle that Jesus predicted, that he told Jairus would happen, occurred. Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. And just to make it clear that this was not just some, you know, kind of weird kind of thing happening. They gave her food. She was astonished. I'm sure she was hungry after the whole ordeal she went through. But just to show that she had been physically raised from the dead. And then Jesus tells them not to share the story with anyone. Now, I don't know why he did that. My guess is that it's probably allowing him to continue his mission so he doesn't get overwhelmed by all these things. But the story is told after, obviously, Jesus is gone. And we hear it here today. Now, I don't know about you, but when we come to stories like this, it can be interesting because it's like there's some connection points here. Maybe we can go with a sense of desperation. Maybe some of us are facing healing and we want to see the power of God work. But I don't think I've ever thought about trying to ask God to raise somebody from the dead. And so as we look at stories like this, we wrestle with, well, what's the connection to my life? But I think there's four important lessons that we can learn. The first one is God's timing is not always our timing, and his ways are not always our ways. Proverbs 19:21 says, "Many are the plans in a person's heart, but it's the Lord's purpose that prevails." And Proverbs 3, verse 5 through 6 says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge and submit to him, and he will make your path straight." And the reason where I get this is just think of Jairus. I mean, think of this man who's going through that emotional roller coaster of thinking God's going to work and bring his daughter healing at first and then facing that setback when he gets the news that she's passed. And think about all the things that's going on in his brain in that moment, wondering where is God in all of this? But yet what we see here is that Jesus worked in all of this and he revealed that he was the Messiah. We saw it earlier that when John asked if he was the Messiah, all these healings pointed to that he was the fact there. He was, in fact, the Messiah that had been promised. And so this is just another one of those ones to show us that. But it reminds us of this truth, that God's timing is not always our timing, and his ways are not always our ways. And when we face difficult circumstances, when we face these things that cause us to question and wonder, we need to lean on that truth. There's lots of times I've faced this in my own life, but there's one that really sticks out to me. Most of you know that I was a mechanical engineer before I became a youth pastor, and then I became eventually a pastor. But, well, a youth pastor and a pastor are really the pastor. It's just a different focus. But the pastor of Crossway Church. And what you may not know is that I wasn't really sure if I was called to ministry. About a year into being an engineer, the youth pastor I worked under, his name was Jim Hewlett, had washed my feet and said, I think you need to think about this. But I had my own plan for my life. I wanted to become an engineer and go into management. I knew engineering wasn't fulfilling. It uses my way my brain worked, but I thought I had to give management a shot before I could think about going into ministry. And so about 2 years into it, engineering, the company I worked with was actually talking to me about becoming a production manager. I'd played different management roles in the company. When my engineering manager was gone, he let me be the manager. And when the production managers were gone, I would fill in for them. And so they were expanding, the company was booming, and they were adding a fourth management position in the production line, and they thought it may make sense to bring in an engineer. And so I was in kind of final negotiations for them with that. I was working hard to kind of get some leeway that I had to work with kids and kind of playing that game. But all of a sudden, things shifted because they got some new contracts and they needed all the engineers they could. They actually had to add about three or four new ones, and so they could afford to lose another one. And so I became the orange engineer instead of management. I'd love to say that I went through that whole process going, oh, great, this is awesome. I can become the lead of an orange harvester. This is awesome. But that wasn't my way. See, I had my plan. I thought I knew the way that God was going to work. God was going to let me become a management so I could see if this is where I was called, and then I was going to move on to ministry if that's where he was going to call me. And I got to say that it wrestled with it. I had more of those feelings that I think Jairus went through in that moment. God, what are you up to? What are you doing? We had a plan, and now you're not doing it. There's some key words in there. We, not you. And I remember, it weighed on me a lot harder than I'd like to admit, but in the deep down in my soul, I had this sense. Brad, do you trust me with your life? Do you trust that even though you may not understand what's going on, I do? That's where it started. And as time went on, it got to, the Spirit worked in my heart and shifted it to where even though I was frustrated, even though I was angry, even though I was upset, it started to go, God, I don't know what or why you're doing. But help me trust that you have a plan for me and you can use this to shape and grow me. Jairus had that moment. As brief as it may be, when he found out that his daughter was dead, of who was he going to trust, his plan or God's plan? And it's a pretty miraculous thing, but we all face those kind of moments. For me, what it led to is giving up the dream of management and realizing I didn't need to do it. Instead, God had called me to ministry, and He brought me to a church that was crazy enough to hire me with 2.5 years of youth ministry experience and an engineering degree, and it was a good fit. But there was this trust that needed to happen. Just because it wasn't my plan, and just because it wasn't my timing, doesn't mean that it wasn't right and it wasn't God's timing. And I think Jairus reminds us of that truth. And so I want you to think about that today. What are you going through? What are those things that cause you to doubt God's timing? And I encourage you to trust that God's timing is correct and trust him. He is the sovereign God of the universe and he knows you better than you know yourself. And we may not always understand why we go through things. Some of them are painful and we'll never know why, but we need to trust. And that's what this story reminds us of. There's another truth here, and that is this idea of an unclean woman touching the clean Jesus and Jesus' cleanliness overcoming it, I think, is a powerful one. Yesterday, the last 2 days, my neighbor let me borrow his tractor, and so we had to move a bunch of wood chips, and I'm thankful that he let us borrow his tractor because it was a lot of work with the tractor, and I can't even imagine what it would have been like without it. We had a whole landscape dump truck full of them dropped off, but a hydraulic hose split a leak, and I had to fix it. It was easy. I used to be a mechanical engineer, and I had to fix harvesters and fix hydraulic lines. It was simple, just go get a part. But I was reminded, I forgot how messy hydraulics are. I took the thing off, I wiped the thing down, and I looked at my hands, and they were completely dirty. I mean, it looked like somebody was trying to take my fingerprint, you know? I mean, and everything you touch was just rubbing it off. So I went inside, I put it in a bag. It was too short to really tie it in. I put it in a plastic bag to try and keep that, washed my hands, went into the car. As soon as I laid it down, what happened? It popped out, and I grabbed it, and it's dirt. My hands are dirty again, and I had the choice. Do I want to go inside and try and clean them up, or do I just deal with the fact that this thing's going to make me dirty, and let's just wipe off the car later? I went with that choice. But that's the way our world works, isn't it? It's like something unclean makes something, or something clean makes something unclean dirty. But I think this story of the woman who touched, and in the Jewish mind, when she touched Jesus, even his cloak, her uncleanliness would have transferred to him. But instead, she declares this powerful story to the entire crowd who's pressing in on Jesus. I was unclean. I had bleeding. And I touched your cloak, and I was miraculously healed. This would have been radical. And I think it points us to the cross. Because on the cross, Jesus makes the spiritually unclean clean. You should recognize this verse because I used it for our assurance. It says, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. And I think this story of desperation and clinging to Jesus is a great reminder to us of what we do spiritually. That when we reach out to Jesus in faith because of the power of the Holy Spirit, because of the work that he did on the cross, we are made clean. God made him who had no sin to become sin for us so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. There's another aspect to the story that I think is important, and that is this. Because the unclean made the clean clean, because the clean made the unclean clean, Jesus adopts this woman into her family, and that's one of the truths. I remember I used that phrase, daughter, that's why he did it. And I think it's important for us to remember that in that moment, because of what Christ has done, Jesus adopts all of us into his family, into the family of God. And if you look at the language that he uses, that familiar language of my child to Jairus' daughter and to this woman, my daughter, all of this highlights that God brings all kinds of peoples into the family of God. The rich and the poor, those who have their life all together and those who seem as far away from God as possible. But all of them equally cry out, Abba, Father. And the Spirit testifies to their adoptionness. It's interesting. I'm reading this book called The 3D Gospel. It's pretty short, but it highlights how our cultures are really, all the cultures of the world kind of have these three axes of which they are. There's the kind of a transactional, kind of a righteous, kind of a legal way, and there's a shame-based culture. And in the shame-based culture, which it's all about honor and shame and feeling like, I let my family down, which is very much the Jewish culture and very much what this woman would have felt, who felt unclean who was unclean for 12 years. Jesus uses this language that says the shame is gone and now you're part of the family of God. And I think that's important for all of us, especially I think our culture is actually moving more to the shame-based cancel culture where people are in and out, and once you say the wrong thing, you're bashed, and we want nothing to do with you. But the gospel fights that because the gospel brings all kinds of people into his family, even those who disagree on different things or in different wealth status or life experiences. All are part of the family of God. And the last thing we see here is that Jesus has conquered death, so we need not fear it. 2 Timothy 1, 9, 10 says, he saved us and called us to a holy life, not because of anything we've done, but because of his own purpose and grace This grace was given us in Christ Jesus before the beginning of time, but has now been revealed through the appearing of our Savior, Jesus Christ, who has destroyed death and has brought life and immortality to light through the gospel. We serve a powerful God. Jesus, in this story, in just this little snippet shot of him raising Jairus' daughter from the dead, shows us what he's going to accomplish on the cross, where he proves to the world that he has defeated sin and death through his resurrection on the cross. And so for those of us who may go through life and we wonder, especially sometimes as we get closer to death, there can be this fear, what's going to happen to us? This image of Jairus' daughter and the tenderness that Jesus has towards her, of bringing her to new life, my child, is an image that we have. Because one day we all will be in the place of this younger girl. One day death will come for us all and you and I will die. But all of us, because those of us who have put our faith in Christ, in Jesus, will have that same welcoming. Welcome home, my child, and we will get to spend eternity with God. And so we do not need to fear death because Jesus has conquered it. These are some truths that I think we can learn from it. That our timing, God's timing, don't always line up. God's ways and our ways don't always line up. That the story points to an even deeper truth, and that is that Jesus provided a righteous payment for us so that even though we're sinners, he purifies us, not because of our own righteousness, because of his. And that's an important truth because it brings us into the family of God. And it also showed us in that moment that Jesus defeated sin and death, and so we do not need to fear, no matter what happens to us. May these truths sink deep into our hearts here today. Let's pray.
You have just watched a sermon from Crossway Church in Battleground, Washington. We hope that you enjoyed it, and we'd love to have you come join us for a worship service on Sunday at 10 a.m. at 311 North Parkway Avenue in Battleground, Washington. If you'd like to find more information about us online, you can find it at crosswaychurchwa.com.